Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good evening, planet Earth. Welcome to the 26th episode of Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
And I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And we're your co-hosts for this journey into all things fermented. So tonight we've got a great show. We're going to start by talking to Nick Harbour, who brought a table beer. So it's kind of part two of our continuing our table beer discussion from last week. And then we're going to move into milk kefirs with Angela Davis. So I'm excited.
I'm very excited about this. I don't know much about kefir. I did go to your seminar at a ferment meetup recently, and I really enjoyed it. Okay, but great. I have not done it yet.
So, Chris, let's start with, we have a couple of announcements or side notes. So, what week is this?
This is Mead Week. Happy Mead Week, everybody. In the aftermath of American Craft Beer Week was last week, I hope everybody went out there and supported local craft beer and American-made beer. It was craft beer. It's an awesome time in the world right now, and to celebrate these in their own weeks that we've dedicated towards them is a fun thing to do. But there was never a Mead Week, and so I, unofficially announced this week as being Mead Week. Mead is a fermented honey beverage that is, I believe, very underappreciated, and it's rather hard to get here in New York City. So I started a website called Mead Week NYC, NYCMeadWeek.org. And it has all the information on basically what mead is, different links to different meads that are sold in New York City and where to get them both by bottle or to go enjoy it at a pub. And please support the places that serve it. Go out, get yourself some mead. And there's a couple links on there on how to make your own. Go to the farmer's market, get some honey, and make some mead.
Yep. That's a work in progress, so it's a little light this year. But the New York City Homebrewers Guild annual mead meeting is tomorrow night, so I just bottled 5 short meads that we made a couple weeks ago, right before we came over to the studio. So I'll excited be serving about
some,
that.
Yeah, I learned it from watching you, Mary. I have some short mead that I'm serving at 5:08 at come the end of the week as well. Strawberry peppercorn short mead. And our guest at the New York City Homebrewers Guild is a guy named Michael Fairbrother, who runs a really great meadery called Moonlight Meadery. And he's also going to be the guest tomorrow night, or one of the guests tomorrow night on Jimmy Carboni's show, Beer Sessions Beer Radio. And then he's coming to us to do that. But then also Jimmy's number 43 on Wednesday, we're going to have a Moonlight Meadery informal tasting. So if you're around New York City and East Village, come through that.
Yep. And I will say, this leads into a discussion since we're talking short meads, that they've posted the seminars. The American Homebrewers Association has posted seminars for the National Homebrewers Conference that's in Philly. Mm-hmm. So you can see the full schedule, and I will be talking about short meads and other kinds of fermented, what I call alternative fermentations. One of the last seminars on Saturday is mine, so I'm really excited about that.
So we're tired with all the beer stuff or the normal traditional stuff.
Yep.
Come see her wacky.
We're going to talk beer too, but we're going to talk about some non-traditional beer making for unusual situations, time crunches, and then a lot of alternate fermentations.
Fermenting on the flip side.
Yep.
Speaking of flip side, tell us about your beer, Nick Harbour. Thank you so much for bringing this beer and for doing this little table beer. So we were going to do a table beer competition as part of Foment About It, and that's why you originally made this beer, right?
Yes. thanks for having me on. Anyway, so this beer is a smaller version of the kind of I think it's my best beer to date. It's kind of an extinct style called a grisette. So I made a very small version of that beer and made it for the table beer competition, which is an interesting learning experience. If anybody's ever tried to make a table beer, like, there's a lot of problems that can arise, like the oversparging and all that kind of stuff. So I had to kind of plan that stuff out in advance. But the idea here is I made a 2.5% alcohol beer, and then when it was over, started like, well, as I was brewing it, actually, this was about a 20-hour brew day to make this beer. So it was very simple ingredients, yeah, but kind of a complicated process. The main thing that makes this beer kind of weird is that I boiled it for 10 hours. So there's only 5 pounds of grain in this 5-gallon batch. It was like 4 pounds of Belgian Pilsner and a pound of white wheat. And
you boiled it for 10 hours.
Yeah, so there was a decoction mash in there, and then there was a 10-hour boil to try to develop those Maillard compounds as much as I could. And I've just been experimenting with that a lot over the last few months of those extremely long boils, because there was a period in you know, Belgian history where that was very common. So I'm trying to kind of recreate those style beers. And one thing I've noticed, particularly with this recipe, is when you use a lot less grains, the rate at which those compounds develop or how much they develop really slows down. So this beer, I mean, it doesn't look very dark. I mean, the people listening in can't see it, but it looks kind of maybe like an ordinary bitter, kind of, maybe like an SRM would be.
Golden honey.
Yeah,
honey, it's a honey color.
So it's not as dark as you would expect it to be, having been boiled so long. It's just because there was so little grain in there. But when the beer started out, it was, you know, almost, it was I would say below straw. It was like almost just clear. There was just so little oomph in the beer from the grain. So as it was boiled, then I, at flame out, infused it with a bunch of milk thistle tea, which just to, you know, just make it those. Thinking of maybe doing like a milk and honey kind of thing. Unfortunately, though, in the end product, I don't think the milk thistle tea didn't really come out too strong. I think you need to use a lot more. I used like 2 ounces, which I thought might be too much, but ended up not being enough. It's just not a very strongly flavored tea. And
did you get a lot of flavor from that long boil? I mean, did it?
Oh yeah, it's significantly changed. So you can taste in the beer itself. That's still one of the more prominent notes in there. Because you're not really tasting a whole lot of the barley flavor or wheat flavor, but the remnants of the grain left over is just from the melanoidin that was formed. So that balance with I think the key point of the flavor besides that would be the fact that I kegged this with about a pound of honey, and put it straight at like 32 degrees, so the honey was completely unfermented. So it's almost like a soda. It's the honey's just there to purely just back sweeten the beer. It's not actually fermented at all. I didn't want the alcohol to be raised. And the idea being that, you know, if table beers were served, you know, at a dinner table back in the day, you might have had kids, you know, that needed to drink because they couldn't drink the water. And how do you get a 5-year-old kid to drink a beer? You probably throw some honey in there for him. So that was the idea. But, yeah, I kind of ran with the concept there a little bit on the name Uncle Creepy's Children's Beer.
Uncle Creepy's Children's Beer is the name of your beer. So in total it took you 20 hours to make this beer? Is that what you said?
Yeah, start to finish.
That's a very long time to be making a beer. And you made 5 gallons. Do you think you would ever do this on a 1-gallon batch, Mary?
No.
I think there's alternate methods you could use for a 1-gallon batch. I've been playing with using a crock pot, like taking some dry malt extract, throwing it in a crock pot, letting that run overnight to make the melanoidin.
That's very
smart.
Then
throw that back in. So I'm actually gonna try that like next weekend, making an extract version of my grisette using a crock pot.
Yeah, and you could even do like a partial mash. So you could still do a traditional, you know, all grain mash, and then just add a little bit of your caramelized.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna do. So just do the regular. So do. Replace some of the base grain with like the dry malt extract that I made in the crock pot.
Mm-hmm.
And then just add that back in before boil.
Very cool. Yeah. And you could do this with other styles too, I'm sure. Have you used that technique with this caramelization technique?
No, not really. I mean, apart from just this style of beer, I haven't done the crock pot thing yet at all. So that might be a disaster, so don't. You know, don't want your listeners to run out and start crock-potting all their beers.
I think it's worth checking out, too.
I think you could also, it would be interesting to do if you did a smaller batch of beer. So say you just did a 3-gallon or 5-gallon traditional mash, all grain mash, mm-hmm. and then I wonder if you could, go through your boil and then you do this crock-pot method and you add that at the end of, you know, you blend at the end of the boil, you could get like 3 different beers from the same batch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Something to think about doing in the future.
Agreed.
So thanks very much. And we're going to crack this open, but we're going to move over to Angela. Good night. Welcome, Angela.
Good evening. Welcome.
And we actually met you through a meetup group that you help run. That is meets in Jimmy's number 43. Yep. So what's the name of the meetup?
Yeah, we're NYC Ferments, and we meet on the first Monday of the month at Jimmy's 43 in the side room. I organized that with Michaela Hayes, who's a good friend of mine, and also has a sauerkraut company called Crack and Jar.
And she's actually going to be a future, I guess, on one of the future shows.
Oh, awesome. Here. That's great.
So it's because it's on Monday, we've only made it to one meeting at the very end.
It's unfortunate.
But I know you guys are having your June meeting on a Wednesday.
Yes, because Jimmy's got something else going on that night.
Yeah, so that's the first Wednesday of June. And we'll reannounce that on next week's show
for
people that want to go. But it's a cool thing. Now, wait, and your theme is garlic, right?
So we've had different themes. This past month, our theme was sort of all different kinds of probiotic tonics. So people brought kefirs, water kefirs. People brought beet kvasses, kombuchas, different kinds of kombuchas. So it was really fun. Next month, we're going to do garlic. So anything it could be fermented garlic or anything that's fermented and garlic added to it.
Right.
So it'll be interesting.
I can see. It makes me want to make a garlic soda.
All the vampires will be scared.
Yes.
Somebody brought a garlic beer to National Homebrewer Conference last year. That was very interesting.
I remember that.
I will reserve judgment.
I don't think that was one of my favorites. And now also, you recently did an intensive with Sandor Katz.
Yes.
Who I like to call the godfather of fermentation in this country. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so twice a year, Sandor does a intensive workshop down in his workshop space in Short Mountain, Tennessee. And it took 4 days of just sort of fermenting and hanging out with other fermentation geeks. And it was just really a lot of fun. And actually, currently, where he does his workshops, it actually is on a operating distillery that actually produces moonshine. So that was really interesting to also have that as well. We got to just tour the facilities and what have you.
That's cool.
Legally.
Actually, he did. It is legal. A couple years ago, his friend actually met some moonshiners in the area, and they were doing it, but not legally. And then he decided to kind of come together and got a ballot initiative, because actually had been a dry county. And got it passed to actually have a distillery and they have a regional moonshine. And I'd never had moonshine before. It was very strong.
Yeah.
They have two varieties, kind of a plain one and then an apple pie. And that one's a little bit more tame and doable, at least for me.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. Do they package those in mason jars, perchance? Do you know?
No, they do. They were in sort of traditional bottles. Yeah,
and it seems like I might have come across those.
We
somewhere.
Saw the apple pie moonshine on their trip to Maryland.
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So what did you guys do in the
Everything.
In your days down there? What are your takeaways? What did you come back and you're like, oh my God, that was so exciting.
It was great. There was about 14 of us that were doing it, and we made a number of different things. We did, we did tempeh, we made miso, yogurt, kefir. We did mambu, which is it's a Caribbean style kind of fermented drink. That Sandra had a culture for.
And what was that? What was the base kind of?
It's uses it's almost sort of like root beery, but a little bit stronger than that.
Oh, wait. I think I got ingredients for that recently. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, so we did that, and we did some wine as well. We made a blueberry. We tried to make a blueberry wine. Actually, didn't quite work. We didn't get enough yeast going for that one. But it was great, and I think the biggest takeaway is just the opportunity to meet so many great people who are doing fermentation. And I am excited about trying to try tempeh at home, which is could be a little bit challenging, but trying to get the right temperature. But I think that would be really a lot of fun to do, and all the different varieties that you can do.
Yeah, and that's something that you had not done before you went down there.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cultured bean and grain product that's native to Indonesia. Locally here, Barry's tempeh is kind of the local tempeh that we have.
I know I've had tempeh before, but I've never thought about making it. I took a seitan class at some point, but different thing.
Yeah.
Our neighbor's in a band called Satanicide. I don't know if you knew that. Different jersey.
So Sandor does this twice a year?
Yes, he does. And actually right now, he's renovating a cabin, which is probably a couple miles away, that it's actually going to be his more permanent home for his fermentation educational center. And he'll continue to run the intensive, but also he's going to take on apprentices who will be
cool.
there for longer periods of time. So it's really exciting. It's an old 1820s cabin that he's restoring. It's totally off the grid. So he's going to have solar panels and and everything. So it's really awesome and exciting. He's hoping to have that up and ready for next year.
And his website, I believe, is called Wild Fermentation.
Yes, it is.
And you can find information. He actually lists his programs as well as other fermentation programs, like, because he listed the Ferment
yeah, exactly.
program and on his website. So that's a really good source for, you know, anything fermented around the country.
Yeah, exactly. There's tons of great resources and links to all different kinds of fermentation resources and other fermenters and other people who are doing fermentation artisanal businesses across the country as well.
And they've got a good forum too with tons of good information.
Yeah, and the Facebook page for Wild Fermentation also is a really great resource for troubleshooting and asking questions. And everyone's really, you can, if you like, what is this? And people like put the photo up and like, does this look okay? And people are usually there to help out. So that's a good resource as well.
Yeah, I just joined that a month ago and it's awesome.
Yeah.
So we're actually going to take a break, but we're going to come back and we're going to continue talking about alternative fermentations and specifically milk kefir.
Okay, great.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back to Ferment About It, HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're here with Angela Davis to talk about milk kefir. We keep throwing this word around, kefir, but what is kefir?
Yeah.
Okay, so kefir is a cultured milk product, and it's sort of like a drinkable yogurt, basically. It actually originated in the Caucasus Mountain region of the world, which is where the area where Europe meets Asia. And in Turkish, the term kefir actually means like feel good or good feeling. It kind of has two purposes you could think about. One is that in that part of the world, the people who drank it on a regular basis had very good health, and they saw the health properties of it. It also has a tiny bit of alcohol. So that also, you could think about that too.
How tiny?
It depends on how long it ferments, because it does have it, because kefir is made comprised of bacteria and yeast, so the yeast quality actually is what produces the alcoholic effect. And it can range from just very sort of minute parts, I guess, until at least like one, it could be like 1 or 2%. So it just depends. The longer you ferment, the more alcohol you're going to get.
It could be as strong as Uncle Creepy's children's beer.
that's
bordering on.
I had one jar once that I forgot about that was in my refrigerator at work, and it was like 3 months, and it was quite
in the two range.
It felt like kind of like a cider that you get and then you kind of let it go, that it hasn't been pasteurized, and it has sort of has that kind of about of alcoholic effect.
Where it's just slightly fermented.
Yeah,
there is. I mean, fermented milk, I think, to American culture is an odd thing. I mean, we drink yogurt a lot, but there's a lot of other cultures that have fermented milk products that we don't get here. So I don't know, kefir, like we've talked about milk kefir, and Chris, who loves yogurt, is a little freaked out by milk kefir.
Yeah, I'm a consistency freak. I like hard yogurt. I don't like soft yogurt. And I think milk kefir is great, but there's a texture thing for me that I'm not the biggest fan of. But I like water kefir.
Yeah, and they're a little bit, they're definitely different. I think it can be a little bit of an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. First of all, like you said, it is more like a drink. It can get thicker, but definitely does not get as thick as yogurt. And it has a much more sour, kind of pungent flavor to it.
I love that.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I can drink it straight. I like it the most when I kind of blend it with smoothies, which is something you would also do with yogurt, mm-hmm. where you put in some banana, put in some berries, and then just sort of blend it up. And that's really tasty that way.
So if people want to start out with milk kefir, so let's start. You start out with grains, and the grains are basically a SCOBY.
Right, exactly. So similar.
What's a SCOBY?
So similar to kombucha, there is a SCOBY, which stands for a symbiotic community of bacteria and yeast. And so this helps culture the milk. And so actually I brought one here today. There are these little granules, and they look almost like, you know, cottage cheese, or depending, you know, this is a kind of a little bit of a bigger one, or even like small florets of cauliflower. Mm-hmm. And they call them grains, but there's no actual gluten or any kind of grain to it. They're just gelatinous kind of mass of the bacteria and yeast together. And so it's really easy and simple, which is kind of one reason I got into it. I tried my hand at yogurt, and you know, I've gotten better, but initially I had some failed attempts at yogurt because you've got to heat it to a certain temperature, you know, then bring it down, put the culture in, which is usually just some extra of the yogurt, previous yogurt, and then maintain a certain warm temperature. And the ease of kefir is that basically you get your milk, you have your grains, and then you place them in there, and then you just let it sit at room temperature for, you know, 24 hours to 36 hours, and then strain out the culture, and then that's it. So it's really pretty easy to maintain, and there's no, like, having to... It also, in terms of temperature, too, if you... It's pretty flexible. So if it's colder, it will just take a little bit longer to ferment. And then if it's warmer, I mean, it's going to just speed up a little bit quicker. Ideally, around 70 degrees is about the ideal temperature mm-hmm. for it to ferment at.
And I know, because one of the things, because I had looked this up recently, because yogurt typically, like you were talking about, that's a thermophilic, I think it's called, the process where it depends on heat. There are yogurt cultures that are mesophilic, or you can do at room temperature, but we don't really see those as often.
There are a couple of them. Cultures for Health, which is a online distributor of different kinds of cultures, does sell them. Although there's a little bit of dispute whether they actually are yogurts. Sandor Katz was talking about this because he says the only relationship we have to cultured milk is we call everything yogurt. Some of the things that they've called, like Vile, which is like a Swedish culture, he doesn't actually technically think that's a yogurt, but they refer to it as a yogurt.
But it's probably more of a kefir.
Well,
maybe, or some other...
Or just some other cultured milk product.
Yeah.
But for us, everything has to relate, in this country, has to relate back to yogurt. So,
yeah.
But that's one of them that I can think of. And it is mesophilic, so it doesn't depend on temperature.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, you know, besides, now also, like, I was reading actually the Culture for Health site, and they said that kefir has the ability to actually populate your inner colony. You know, it has different health benefits than yogurt does.
Yes, exactly. And the main benefit, I think, is that, so yogurt is great to consume. And I think it's good to have a diversity of these different products. But it has a transient bacteria, so it kind of goes through and it does help with digestion. But with kefir, you have the beneficial bacteria and yeast. And there's actually about 30 different strains, so it's at least that are known. There could even be more. Mm-hmm. And those bacteria and yeast do actually colonize your gut and help to repopulate it with good beneficial bacteria, which we all need these days, considering the fact that we don't eat a lot of probiotic foods, and we're constantly sort of being exposed to lots of things that can destroy the beneficial bacteria that we have.
Mm-hmm. When you said 30 different strains, you mean 30 different strains of bacteria or of yeast or of grains?
30 different strains of bacteria and yeast that are that have been identified.
In most or all, and these are common to all milk kefir grains.
To kefir grains.
Okay.
Yes. Now, the thing that people might be familiar with is that increasingly in our stores we do see kefir products. I would say those are cultured milk products, but they're not actually true kefir because kefir can only come from these grains, which have been passed down for hundreds of years. Actually, probably dates back at least 1,000 years, and you can't create it. They've tried to create this symbiotic community in a lab, and it's not possible. So what you see in the stores is about probably 10 to 15 different kinds of strains. So, you know, it definitely has a benefit, but it's not the same product, and you're not getting the same beneficial bacteria and yeast that you would get from the actual true grains.
Yeah, and that's actually interesting because we heard Sander Katz speak at the Natural History Museum a few weeks ago, or about a month ago, and he actually mentioned that with yogurt the same way. There are certain, you know, like the local smaller farms are using, you know, a lot of the strains of yogurt that have a lot of bacteria. But otherwise, some of the commercial yogurt that we buy, they have like three strands of lacto and a strain of streptococcus. It's like very specific strains, and that's, you know, it's more of a chemically lab created yogurt.
Right, exactly. So, and he discovered that a couple years ago, because there's all these other hair, you know, because he said, I know how every time when he would make his yogurt, after a while, it got weaker and weaker. And yeah, like that can't exist.
Yeah.
How would they have been going for thousands of years? And they discovered there are these heritage cultures that are more pure. And he's used them for like 30, 40, 50 generations. But these grains will last forever. They actually literally, if they're treated properly, they will not die. Now that's the issue. The one thing that makes it a little bit more challenging than say yogurt is that these the grains, they're like a pet, and they need to be fed about every day or so. They need fresh milk, and they can also be used for other kinds of non-dairy drinks or milks. So you could do it in soy milk or coconut milk or almond milk, but they do need to go back to, after a week or so, they do need to go back to milk because lactose, you could be cow's milk or sheep's milk because that's where they came from. That's what they were born of.
Yeah.
So if you can do that.
Now, do you ever do, so you said a lot of times you'll drink it straight, but then you also like blend it with smoothies. Is there another way to get flavorings? I mean, I guess you could blend it with strawberries.
You could also do a second fermentation. So after you've done the first fermentation with the grains, you could take the grains out, and then you can leave them, so you leave the batch without the grains out, and then you could add fruit, you could add orange peels. I've done that. It has a nice orange flavor, cinnamon, anything that you'd like. So you can have that other. You can experiment and see what different flavors. I've heard of adding different kinds of beneficial herbs as well.
And then for a secondary, so that's exactly what I do with my water kefir. And then you just leave it for like a day or like 24 hours or so for the secondary fermentation.
Exactly, that same thing.
Now, do you ever get any carbonation with milk kefir?
You can. I'm always afraid of bottles exploding, but you can actually, if you close it very tight or you use an airlock, you would definitely get that effervescence as well.
Yeah, and I think carbonated milk, I mean, I've had carbonated milk from other cultures, but that's something we never see in America, and I really enjoy it. I don't think I would want, or not carbonated straight milk, but carbonated, you know, kind of sour or fermented milk.
Yeah, they do sometimes call it the champagne of milk, kefir, because of that effervescence and the champagne-y kind of quality that you can get when it doesn't have that carbonation.
Yeah.
And that's one reason also why it's probably not commercially sold from the grains, because similar to the issue we had a couple years ago with kombucha, is that at the point of distribution, there could be a possibility as it continues, because it's going to continue to ferment even when it's in the refrigerator, that you could get an unregulated amount of alcohol.
Right.
So that's another reason why they probably would not want to do it with the grains, because that would happen.
Yeah. So let me ask. So if your people out there want to get their own grains, now you can order them from Cultures for Health.
Correct.
But where else would you recommend?
Yeah, you can check the Wild Fermentation Facebook page. Is a good place that has it,
because they have a swap. Yeah,
they have swaps there. There also is a woman in Ohio, the Real Real Kefir Grains, and she also sells her kefir grains, and she grows them on these Nigerian dwarf goats. So
interesting. So goat milk.
Yeah.
Here. Yum.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's the thing too with the milk. You can use any kind of dairy milk that you want. You can use, it can be, you know, pasteurized. It can be low fat, skim, whole milk, or whatever. I mean, I prefer mine with whole milk. And the only kind of milk that you don't want to use is the you know, the new kind of ultra pasteurized milk, because it's just basically dead. So there's no bacteria living there. So you're just not going to get ferment from that.
Okay. Is it a little too sterile?
Yeah.
Very cool. So I'm trying to think, any other questions? Because I haven't made milk. We haven't made milk kefir before, but I think that answers all the questions that we had.
You said when you first put the grains in, you want to, you put it in the jar and let it sit. But
oh, yeah,
you
want to
make sure
through.
You don't, you make sure you don't tighten that lid all the way. Otherwise, you'll end up with either a broken bottle or a fermented or a carbonated kefir.
Right, exactly. So what you do, what you want to do, just I'll walk you through it step by step. You get the grains. You're going to put them in the bottom of your quart jar. And then you want to pour about, you want to fill it almost to the top, about 3/4 of the way full. You want to go too high because then it could, you know, it could bubble up.
You want some headspace.
Exactly. You want some headspace. Exactly. And then you just want to kind of, you know, stir it around, because that actually kind of increases the area where the grains are getting to ferment the milk. And then you just want to leave it out for 24 hours. Usually put it down in a cupboard or something so it's away from the light. So similar to other fermentations that are sensitive to light. And then, you know, try to put it in somewhat of an area that's going to be about 70 degrees, you know, in your house. Then you just, a couple of different times throughout the fermentation process throughout the day, just give it another little shake or swirl it around just so that, again, the grains continue to get around the milk. And then when you, in about 24 hours, you know, open it up, check it out, you know, do a little taste to see if it's at the sourness that you like. And if it is, then, you know, take the grains, you know, out, usually in like a strainer. You want to be careful to not have it touch anything that's, you know, metal.
Yeah.
So similar to other cultures. So like a plastic strainer, what have you. And then you just take them out, put them in another jar, put the milk in, start it over again.
And then you drink the kefir that you just strained it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And it's ready to go.
It's ready to go. That easy. Exactly. You can drink it right away, or you could let it, you know, cure for about a day or so, just to kind of get that. Because actually, when you do let it sit before you drink, it actually increases some of the it decreases the lactose in it. So for anyone who has any lactose intolerance issues,
right,
there'll be like hardly any. And also, it does increase some of the vitamin B content as well by letting it continue to ferment a little bit longer at room temperature.
My final question is: does kefir freeze? Can you make a kefir lollipop because of the alcohol?
Have heard of people make. I have not done it yet myself, but people making you know, ice cream. I mean, you can definitely do a lot of the things that you do with yogurt. So, like, you could strain it the way out and make a cheese, make dips, make cottage cheese out of it, that sort of thing. And I've heard of the ice cream, which I've been wanting to do.
Well, that's awesome. Fun. Thank you so much for joining us,
yeah,
Angela
thank
Davis
you. It was awesome.
From NYC Ferments,
yes,
Meetup Group, and Nick Harbor from the New York City Homebrewers Guild, and our friend with his Uncle Creepy,
Uncle Creepy's
Children's beer. Grisette, beautiful.
We also want to remind you that Heritage Radio Network is a not-for-profit station, so they need your support. If you enjoy this show and some of their other shows, please show your support by getting a membership. Memberships start at $60, and if you're a homebrewer, you get a 5% discount at Bitter and Esther's, as well as Brooklyn Homebrew, and $1 off draft beers at Jimmy's Number 43. So thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week,
the 27th,
with Yepe from Evil Twin, and Brian from
Brian Ewing from 12% Imports.
And then they're both from Torst.
That's from Torst. Forget about it. See you next week. Sorry, we're late.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.